Welcome to the Foreign Correspondents Club. Thank you all for coming. First of all, a couple of housekeeping notes. Everybody, please turn off your cell phones now, including the reporters, including everybody here seated, governors as well. Make sure we don't want to have any rings during the recording of this. If you want to put it on vibrate, that's okay. But please, everybody, check your phones now and make sure you've done that. Second of all, I'd like to announce our upcoming event. We only have one upcoming event because we're about to go quiet for the holidays, but that's Marvin Farkas, whom probably many of you know here. I believe his membership number here is 004. He came here on a cargo ship, the Eastern Saga, in 1954 and worked as a journalist all over the region and has named his book appropriately the Eastern Saga for the cargo ship that brought him to Hong Kong. That will be on the 15th from 6 to 7:30. So we're doing that as cocktails. With that, I'd like to introduce our guest. Very few magazines seem to inspire the kind of loyalty that The Economist does, and you can judge by the fact that this event was completely sold out. I think of my own father, who started subscribing in 1958 and takes pride in the fact he still has not missed a single issue. He gets them forwarded. He still, at the age of 80, goes through each one and pulls out individual articles and keeps them in files on different countries. So it's an unusual magazine that has inspired that kind of loyalty. At the same time, it certainly has a lot of critics. They suggest it's that people like it maybe because it's Anglophilic, that the Americans like it more than the British, who actually may know it better. So what do the British know that the Americans don't? It's had a succession of critics from people like James Fallows. But it certainly has survived at a time when the electronic media seem to be taking a toll on other news organizations. With that, I'd like to introduce the editor-in-chief, John Micklethwaite. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It's wonderful to be here. I first came here, I think, 25 years ago, shortly before a short and ill-doomed career as a banker with somebody actually who just wandered in. And this is by far the most sober I've been in this place. And I can't think of a better compliment to a place we've come to speak. And whenever anyone talks about the FCC, you immediately think of Hong Kong more than anywhere else. I'd especially like to thank Keith for his introduction, A, for its generosity, and B, for, I gather, the supreme advantage of it not being Tom Easton, my colleague, who apparently normally introduces people, but is not allowed to introduce me, which for me is a huge advantage, because Tom would probably say that he's about to disagree with everything I'm about to say. And I'm going to come back to that at the very end, for reasons you'll be aware. I'm going to begin with by just saying rather threatening words. I see this as starting a conversation. I'm just going to talk for about 20 minutes and then throw it open to questions. I say starting a conversation is threatening because in my experience as a journalist, that is the phrase that politicians use whenever they have absolutely nothing to say. It's a moment of vacuity. It's one which Gordon Brown used as he was heading towards a doomed election defeat. It's what you heard Barack Obama. When Barack Obama started saying he wanted to have a conversation with the American people, you knew he was in trouble. But in this case, it's genuine. It's genuine because, as an editor, above all, I know that trying to talk to journalists is a bad idea. You're much better trying to listen to them. And secondly, I think particularly that I'm here to learn as much to say. What is my position? I would describe my position, and I'm here to talk about journalism, which is not something I normally actually go on about a lot. When I look at the world, when people ask me about the world economy at the moment, I tend to describe it, my own view, as being one of paranoid optimism. Paranoia, optimism, because I think the basic economy seems to be heading the right direction. Paranoia, because I'm always worried about the politics of it. And it strikes me that when I look at our own industry, I come from a rather different view. When I was thinking about it this morning, I would describe my view as optimistic paranoia. It's almost the other way around. Paranoia, because I think that is the only sensible position for any editor anywhere in the world to have at the moment. Our industry has been completely changed in endless different ways. Optimism, because I'd like to try and make the case today that I think on the whole, the situation in our industry is better than many people seem to think. And in particular, I think the situation for journalists and the journalistic opportunity is greater than it tends to be. And I suppose my starting point is a question which I normally get from journalists, and I forgive the egocentrism of this, and that is when, over the past 2-3 years, I've been interviewed repeatedly, despite usually saying, trying to put people off, on the basic theme is, you know, why is The Economist doing well? You're the great exception. Printed journalism's in a terrible position. And it's often tied to a cover we did just shortly after I became editor, which showed, it talked about the death of the newspaper just about the same time as they began to go down. And I suppose my paranoia is that I think, to some extent, whenever I spoke to these people, I used to say that our success was overestimated. And to some extent, it was clung to by people whose papers, own papers, were in a slightly more terrible state. And when people said, you're doing very well, my response was always say, well, look, define well. I'm very proud of our performance. I'm glad that our things have still been going roughly the right direction. But yes, our circulation's been going up, but you know, it did go up faster before. Our advertising dipped like everybody else. And also, I thought it was basically wrong, and Tom would come in this very fiercely, at a time when journalists were having pay freezes and we had staff hiring freezes, those perhaps weren't as bad as job cuts elsewhere. But to claim we were suddenly doing miraculously well seemed wrong. And I think it's sometimes against that batter that I think that people tended to cling on to us as being an example in the opposite direction too much. And I think generally, when I look forward, when I think about the paranoia that springs from that, I think you have to be that way at the moment. There are so many imponderables hanging over our industry. I'll give you just two examples, both really to do with advertisers. The first is the continuing drift of people away from print or print advertisers away to the internet. I don't know, I'm actually for the first time ever trying to do a speech reading it from an iPad, but I don't know on the iPad whether the rates to do with advertising will be the rates people charge for print, in which case we'll all do very nicely, or the rates that people charge for the internet, in which case it'll be much tougher. But by any measure, I think, being or trying to run a newspaper at the moment or trying to run a magazine, there has been more change in the past 5 years, I would submit to people in this room, than there was in pretty much the previous 50, 60 years, I think. And I think that ties a bit into where my argument begins to turn, because I think it's very difficult for us journalists to admit, because we're always used to accusing other people of being complacent or coming from a different era. But I think we did live before this new world descended on top of us in an era of some complacency, I think. And particularly, I was just talking at the table with Keith. I remember in the early 1990s, I remember going to go and work at or to have an office at the LA Times, these huge, big city American newspapers. And I was completely gobsmacked. Keith had apparently been to work there slightly earlier. I couldn't believe there was an organization with so much money which just continually seemed to just pour in. Indeed, Warren Buffett referred to the big American city newspapers as cash machines, and they were like slot machines. All you had to do was show up, and no matter how drunk, badly behaved, or mad the family which owned it was, they would keep on making money because of the classified advertising. Rupert Murdoch called them the rivers of gold. And I'm not saying everyone worked for those sort of organizations, and they sponsored an enormous amount of incredibly good journalism, but it was a different world. You had here an example, we're talking about South China Morning Post, used to be the most profitable business in terms of margins anywhere in the world. But I think it's about that time that my paranoia, and it is a really basic paranoia about what exactly is going to happen to our industry, it begins to get tinged a little bit by optimism, because I think a more normal industry does not necessarily have to be a more defunct one. I'd still generally make the case that our industry, I think to some extent, has oversold itself. And that is partly an industrial call. If you look at the numbers for newspapers, we were just talking about it, you look at the numbers for advertising coming in recently, you look at the profits that some newspapers have announced, and actually they've begun to rebound, even in places like the big American newspapers, where this first torrent of bad news seemed to come from, and where very much we chose it as being the area that we were trying to talk about in terms of the death of the newspaper. I think there's a danger that when journalists analyze themselves, we confuse the structural for the cyclical. Obviously, the bigger danger is the other way around. Everyone was used to advertising going up and down, and then suddenly mistaking this huge structural shift towards the internet, but it is also possible you can do too much the other way around. You can think of things as being all to do with structure, all to do with running to the internet, when in fact, if you have economies which are going through the worst downturn for 70 years, you are bound to see, I think, some degree of going down. And what's also interesting is if you look at it, it's not just a question of cyclicality, at least some of the structural stuff that we all expected to happen hasn't really happened in the way that futurists like to predict. I'd point towards television. Look at the numbers for people using the internet. Look at the numbers for young people on mobile phones. This was supposed to mean they watch less television. Actually, what's happened is they watch even more television than they did before. What's happening is that whilst they're watching television, they're tweeting, they're poking, and all the various other things that you can do watching television. And I can hear you say, okay, well, that's fine. That's okay for game shows. That's okay for those sort of things that young people watch. But what about real journalism? Maybe this slight comeback is a sort of dead cat bounce, or I suppose a dead hack bounce, you could call it. Again, I think it's more complicated than that. And here I suppose I'm focusing, and I should very much stress this, I'm focusing this from an editor's point of view. And I think an editor's job is to write things that bring in people who want to read it. It's the publisher's job then to try and find people who want to advertise against it or set prices. But fundamentally, and again, I was talking about this with Keith at the table, a move back to an era where people are buying you for what you write, I think in some ways is a more healthy one, and one which I think is something we should focus on. Where then is my optimism? If my paranoia is slightly tinted, what are the trends that I think which are going in our direction? And the first one is to point out that I think now, I don't think technology is universally the threat that we've all been brought up and thought it had been for so much of the past couple of years. I think there's really two points there. I'll give one example to do with magazines. And that was when I came in as editor, and you can read the press cuttings, I talked about a hurricane sweeping through our industry, which had crashed through newspapers and was coming straight into magazines. Actually, what's happened, again, a bit like television, is it hasn't quite worked that way. The internet didn't hit magazines in the same way as it hit the reading of newspapers. Young people, if you look at the rates of reading magazines, it's still, by many measures, as high as it was 20 years ago. The difference is that they don't read newspapers as much. The second point is actually, in some ways, it began to create different demands. We found at The Economist, completely against what you might have expected, that actually the demand, all that data, all that information, in some ways created more demand for something which could be a filter through all that. The second thing is to do with the iPad. And here I think this is, for the magazines, much more of a structural and existential threat than in some ways, and I say the iPad, I mean the Kindle, and the, I'm not trying to, I'm very much device agnostic. On the one hand, it is, the iPad is a huge change. It's the first thing, I think, from my perspective, which really sort of rivals the reading of a magazine. And one way to measure it is if you look at the iPad adverts, you can count the number of shoes. Why do I say that? Because you look at the number of people who are lying on sofas, lying on beds, reading things in the same way as you read magazines, because I think people fundamentally read magazines in a different way to they read newspapers. Newspapers, they're leaning forward, they're trying to get information in. Magazines, I see very much as a leaning back, weekend style read where people are in that position. And iPad is deliberately moving into that area. So is the Kindle, so will be the new Android devices. So yes, it's a threat, but also the technology in some ways offers opportunities. It offers opportunities, and I definitely don't think it's the iPad is a Jesus tablet, which is somehow going to save us, but it does offer us opportunities in terms of the way that we can distribute things. You've already seen the way that newspapers have been able to get things much more cheaply to people than ever before. In our case, you can imagine that I was in Brazil a couple of weeks ago, for a Brazilian reader, you sometimes don't get your Economist on Monday or Tuesday the week after. Now you can get it on Thursday night or Friday morning the week before. That's a sizable advantage. I think it's a different sort of product because it's finishable in the same way as a magazine is. You could put it down. I think it offers an opportunity also, to go back to what I said, to charge for content. What's different about these devices is that people, even the young, are prepared to pay for things on it in a way they never really got used to on the internet. It gives our industry, I think, a chance to reconnect that basic contract between you write stuff and if it's valuable, people should be able to pay for it. None of this stops my paranoia, but at least means adds optimistic twinges to it in a way that I didn't see before. The second trend, which I think is going in our direction at least a bit, is what I called part of his talk, which is mass intelligence. What do I mean by that? I think the great assumption between the huge number of people who came to see me was this idea that everything is going down market, that the only way to survive in this new age is to be trashy, to go in the wrong direction. And The Economist was some kind of weird example on the other side. I think the more you look around the media landscape, the wronger that is. There is a much bigger top of the market than people think. And it's certainly not us. It's people in New York. You see many of the representatives up here, but you also see magazines like New Yorker, The Atlantic. You look at your own behavior. Look at the stuff you read. Look at the New York Times bestseller list of books. Look at the things on television. And there is a vast amount of very clever stuff still going on, which people want. Look at the numbers for people going to literary festivals. Look at the numbers for people. All these things are growing enormously pretty much everywhere. And they're growing that way because the number of people going to college pretty much around the world is growing as well. And I think there's also been a split, which is, I think, when I was growing up, back in the days when I came here, there was a sort of division between you were either an intellectual who wore black, smoked gitane cigarettes and watched films with French subtitles, or else you were a normal person. Now people are much more prepared to drift. They want clever intellectual ideas, they want other things as well. It was brought home to me when I went to a lunch in London and met somebody who was going to take his son to go and watch Millwall Football Club, which, believe you or me, is rough stuff in the afternoon. And then the evening was going to go and watch The Lives of Others, an East German film. I didn't see any contradiction between those two things. All our experiences, there are many more people who are prepared to switch between different things. One of the most common things people buy with us in America is Us magazine, which I suppose is a version of Hello or something like that for Americans. So I do think there's something there. And finally, I just mentioned one last thing, which I suppose is a version of globalization and brings me back to the people in this room. I know I'm biased. I know The Economist has been driven by globalization, and it's something, in our case, it's a very obvious sell. You go to people in Ottawa and you say to them, read this magazine, because suddenly what happens in Beijing, what happens in Bangkok, what happens in Sydney matters to you. It's going to make more of a difference to your life than ever before. But I think that applies so much to so much journalism nowadays. I think particularly here, I'm just struck over the past 3-4 days I've been in China and they can come through, is the way in which people now, I think if anywhere in the world people were prepared to pay for information, it is to do with the country you're on the very edge of. If you look at China at the moment, in the West everyone complains about journalism all becoming a commodity. Everyone knows immediately when something's happened, when something hasn't. You sit here on the edge of what is arguably the biggest, but also the most complex, the least easy to understand, the most textured story on Earth. And so I suppose, and I'm wrapping up slightly quickly to allow you to give me questions, my message would be that if you take those three trends together, technology which allows you to reach out to what you write here, to go further than it has ever been before, if you have that growth all the way around the world, and it's not just the West, it's pretty much the growth of an ever bigger, larger, more educated audience for the sort of sophisticated journalism that most of the people I associate with here want to push. And finally, if you associate it with this huge story, which does require elaborate understanding, does require texture, does require more knowledge about what exactly is going on, particularly in China, more than anywhere else, then I think you have a manifesto to go back to your bosses, go back to the editors of the world, and demand enormous pay rises, because you are at the center of which we're going. And that was the final bit where I knew that Tom Easton would disagree with me entirely about that perspective. But I will end on that, hopefully, slightly more optimistic note and ask you for your questions. Thank you.
We appreciate the good cheer in the Christmas season here. Who would like to ask the first question, maybe more of a party pooper question about the prospects here? Reliable David O'Rear, please hear Jude one.
Can I say very quickly, I'm very happy to take questions on anything. I don't. That was the other part of saying starting a conversation.
Thank you very much. As a shareholder in The Economist, being a former employee, I'm delighted to hear that it's doing so well. One of the things I wanted to do when I was an employee was get, at that time on CD and now on my iPad, a searchable database of every single issue ever published. Is it coming someday?
There is one. That's a very technical answer. You can get the past 10 years on the website, and actually now you can get that. We only meter the amount of articles you ask for, so you can get the whole 10 years. I hope I've got this right. But also before that, there is a service which actually the EIU set up, where all the digital issues, all the issues ever since 1843 have been made available. But it was a partnership with another company, and you get it through universities. But there is a way of doing it. If you send me an email, I'll put you in contact.
Thank you. I was looking for the one on my iPad that I can
browse. On the iPad, I think you'd have to get the. I think it's actually Thompson who've done it. So you'd have to persuade them to hand over the money.
Tara?
Sorry, I'm...
You can subscribe. Hello. Your magazine, very much the brand, is about traditional, British, intellectual, all of these things that make you a successful brand. But you're talking about a changing technology landscape, a different world, a different sophistication. So are you going to change your brand and the tone of your magazine as time goes on? Will there be a subtle change in your writing style, in the length of your articles, or are you not thinking about that yet?
No. Sorry, my answer was no, rather quickly. No, because I think the actual, this is going to sound pompous, but I think the actual, your description of us, I think, is wrong. We've always been a liberal, radical, and very, very much driven by technology ever since we started. We began by writing about railways, which are the big technology of our thing. And actually, in terms of America, which Keith very kindly mentioned, our readership there was built up, I think, very much on the back of science and technology, and the people, the famous Americans you associate with reading us, tend to come from the software industry and places like that, and they came to us from there. But I think that would be one part of it. The second answer would be, I don't see, as long as the basic weekly product keeps on selling, and I'm very ambivalent, not ambivalent, I look and see whether it's going to be in print or on digital. That's, you know, my job is to produce a product which people want to buy. That's fundamentally what it's about. If they want to buy it on an iPad, that's great. If they want to buy it in print, that's great, and you can get both for the same price. But that's really all it's about. And our basic thought is that the weekly experience of reading The Economist as a weekly product, as a filter for your news, I'm sorry, that makes sense. In terms of things like the web, we see that going in a different direction. So there it's more blogging, it's more discussion, and that, I suppose, is where we slightly come up against Reuters more. But it's both, those are two, I think, in our mind at the moment, two very different products, and it's the balance between the two. So yes, in terms of the website, yeah, you see more blogging. We even put initials on blogs now. That's how radical we've gone. But in terms of the basic print product, as long as people seem to want what that is, which I think is largely a matter of whether the journalism's good, or that's for others to say. That's where the core of it is. It's not more complicated than that.
It seems that every time the U.S. government wants to start up a new war, it can count on a full chorus line of cheerleaders from the editorial board of The Economist. Iraq, Afghanistan, I don't know whether you've favored invading North Korea yet, but when the Pentagon gets around to it, I'm sure the chorus line will cheer once again. Why is your editorial policy so bloodthirsty?
It's a continual yearn for blood. No, we'll give you an example. We when there was talk about attacking Iran, our initial response was no. So it goes in different phases. But yes, we did support those. So I can't deny that. But since I've been editor, the war I've supported was to increase the surge in Iraq, which I would argue saved a lot of lives.
John Peterstein from the Wall Street Journal. What's happening to the demographic of the Economist readership? When you talk about the point is to increase sales and to increase the readership, but how is the profile of that readership changing? And are you seeing actual evidence that a younger readership is coming to The Economist through the iPad or through other applications than through print? Or is that just a theory at the moment?
I think you see, the answer is in terms of the iPad edition was only launched 2 weeks ago, so it would be meaningless to say, and the Kindle numbers are still fairly small, so I can't tell you. I think in terms of the web, it did skew slightly more towards young readers. The horrible, and it may be the wrong, we're the wrong magazine to ask this, is we, from the editorial point of view, and this is going to sound terrible, we don't pay that much attention to who our readers are. The way we've always eschewed focus groups, any of those things, because I think those have been the death of some other organisations. We still, if you try and cover the world in one small bit, in the end, all you can do really is trust your judgment, rightly or wrongly, and follow that. Because you can never, if we try to write something which pleases the Chinese, it will annoy the Germans, or you know, just look at the split between America and Europe to begin with. But in general, I think you're right. Is the internet has been the numbers I've seen, the internet has been slightly younger, and it varies in country. At one time, our British readership was slightly older than our American one, for instance.
But, sorry, has the age of the Economist readership changed over time?
Generally, I think the answer has come down a bit, but we can. I wouldn't feel confident about the numbers.
Rather than having the board monopolize the questions here, let's take some more questions from the floor. Who would back in the corner here, please?
Hi, John. A while ago, your CEO said that the Economist is in the business of simplify and exaggerate. That's his terms. I would love to hear your editorial response to it.
Sorry, the question was simplify and exaggerate.
That's Andrew's words.
Exactly. That's a phrase which has gone. I think simplify and exaggerate is something we certainly apply to covers. I think I would have no question with that. I think otherwise, I mean, it wasn't really Andrew. It was a guy called Norman McRae, who was one of the great presiding geniuses of The Economist, or the presiding, who died actually last year, or died earlier this year. But he was once asked and said that was what he did. And the sort of ideas that he got hold of were things like back in the 60s, he suddenly said Japan was going to grow enormously. And then the internet, he sort of, in a weird way, predicted in the 1980s. And they were taking simple ideas and then trying to push them. And I think that's part of the value of it. I think there's a great value for magazines. And here I think there is probably a difference with papers. I think daring to be wrong is something you have to repeatedly, do. I mean, people often say you were the people who said oil would go to, I can't think it was $5 or $10, and it went in the opposite direction. And sure, we got it wrong. My experience of readers is that people, they want to be interested. As long as you present things to them in a reasonable way, then if you're wrong, then they'll forgive you. And that every single person I've ever met who's ever read The Economist, and in Tom's case, written for it, always begins with, I disagree with you about X and X and X, but I still read you. And I think that is, having a point of view gives you, I mean, we have the original liberal push of free trade and free minds, so to speak. That's why we were founded. And so that gives you a license to be wrong in some ways. But I think in general, I think if you look at the things which go into trouble, it tends to be what I said, the sort of focus group thing, where you try and work out what people want to hear and then devise something for it. And it doesn't really work, I don't think.
Over here on the end, Mike.
Mark Michelson, another former Economist employee, but a long time ago. Keith mentioned earlier about the popularity in America of The Economist, and you've just been talking about a point of view. Do you think one of the reasons America at the moment, maybe not historically, but is ideologically divided in many ways? The Economist does take a strong point of view, and not just in America, but does take a strong point of view, but as you know, Jake's question illustrated, it's not always predictable. Whereas in many other publications, it may be. You sort of know where they're going to stand, whether it's a war, for example, or whether it's a certain economic move. Do you think that approach contributes, or first, do you agree with it, and do you think that approach contributes. In other words, that you have a point of view, but at the same time, it's perhaps a little different. It's not an automatic point of view as perhaps some other.
I think we're very lucky in America, particularly, but in most, actually in Britain, I think probably as well, is that we're not identified with a party. We would say we are liberals completely through and through. And unfortunately, in America, that term was taken and made into Nancy Pelosi. And the idea of a big government liberal is such a mess of what the original creed of liberalism was about that it's mad. But our advantage, both our advantage and our problem, is that we sit so naturally between Republicans and Democrats. We tend to be Republican orientated on matters, on economic matters, because we believe in economic freedom. We tend to be Democrat dominated on social matters, who tend to be pro personal freedom. And so you sit in the middle, and it's a very weird position to be, where continually, if you look at polls, most people are actually quite close to those positions, but the parties aren't. And the same applies in Britain. Occasionally we find somebody like Schwarzenegger, who seems to represent a certain form of hedonistic economic liberalism that we can sort of hang on to. Or Bloomberg, that we were talking about earlier. I think in continental Europe, we are slightly more associated with a particular mindset. We're associated with what they would say Anglo-Saxon liberalism. You know, we're associated with that. I would suspect in bits of Asia we're probably associated with that too. But not. I feel the joy of every election we've ever had. There's been a debate about who we back, with at least one person from this newspaper in this room disagreeing with at least two of my recent ones. But that's the way. And you look at how we backed, you know, Clinton, Bush, Obama. Follow, you know, we follow a strange path.
In some ways, your market niche in the States seems to be almost catering to what David Brooks would call the bourgeois bohemians. That is, slightly right of center, perhaps, on economic policy, slightly left of center on social policy. But it's not just a stereotype. Even the coverage itself does seem to be more center-right of Britain than it does of the United States.
Yeah.
As you've had, even there are occasional allusions to that, even within the pages of The Economist, that the America's section is more center-left. As you and others have moved into the leadership of The Economist, how has that influenced, fed back into coverage, for example, of Europe? Is it as reliably center-right in its coverage, for example, of Britain? It doesn't seem so at times, yeah, as it used to be.
It doesn't, to be honest, it doesn't feed back, really. You take a set of, I suppose we take a set of beliefs and the discipline of economics, if I can again be rather pompous about it, and then we apply it to situations. And again, Tom would say that we should apply it in different ways, but that's the approach we come from. And you tend to, to be honest, I mean, I shouldn't say this, but from an editor's point of view, I feel much, much more comfortable being in opposition. It's a generally much easier position to be. I think the worst thing is to be. If there are two bad things. One is to be immediately identified. I mean, a huge admirer of the New York Times, but I wouldn't immediately expect it to come out for Sarah Palin rapidly, or I wouldn't. That you could tend to know. I don't open the New York Times on election day and have a massive sense of anticipation about which way will they go. And that is. I think it's good to try and avoid that on the whole. But on the other hand, I think also in general, being in opposition, I think it's much easier for editors to be in that position, because otherwise you're stuck with you backed, I mean, situation then, we backed both Obama and Cameron, and people say, isn't it wonderful, your people won. Actually, it makes it more difficult in some ways, because people always say, well, you backed them, you know, look how useless they are. And that is harder.
The New York Times has, in fairness, endorsed Republicans for president, but I think the last one was Eisenhower in 1956. And that was controversial. Over here in the corner, please.
Thank you. Christian Schubert. I'm with BASF, the chemical company. You were saying earlier that you cover the world, or you give a world view. There was that accusation. I don't know who said it, that it's actually a world view that comes from a bunch of Oxford and Cambridge graduates who explain the world to the world. Maybe that's part of your brand image. Will it remain that way? Are you planning to diversify? Has there ever been a non-British chief editor Will that ever happen? I mean, it's a big mystery, but what is the way forward in that regard?
I think they're probably, I see Tom nodding healthily. I think that The Economist is always likely to have a British tone of voice. I don't, in terms of personnel, there's never been any suggestion that you should be British to be editor, and I don't think there ever would be. But I think there's an advantage. I have to be very careful the way I put this. I think it's an advantage in many parts of the world in not being an American America point of view, and that is not being labelled that. And actually, I think it's a sign of Britain's. I would view it slightly as a sign of Britain's decreasing power. And the reason why is that when I often read the cover, and certainly talking to my peers at the American news magazines, they sometimes feel this. If they can say something, and people immediately say, "Oh, that's close to American foreign policy," or that's, and the reason why is anything which happens in the world. If you look at what's happening in the Koreas at the moment, people immediately think that Washington has a dog in that fight. Well, the British don't. Well, we might like to think we do, but we don't in any. There are probably people from the Foreign Office here who will be deeply upset by that statement. But we don't. We don't have enough to count, and so we can credibly say, look, we come from a sort of world viewpoint, and so I think at that precise moment that has been a slight advantage, I think, and to be honest, an unfair advantage, not least because as we just said, we've often backed the Americans.
Okay, if we have just a very quick question, Bonnie Engel, and then we have to wrap up, please.
Oh, there you go. Hi, Bonnie Engel from Asian Art Newspaper out of London. My question was to bring it back to the Asia region and China. What's the relationship with The Economist vis-a-vis China? Are you censored? Are you distributed at all? Are you just available in Western hotels? You know, how's that going?
We have, I think, 4,000. Please check the website and it'll tell you the exact number. I think it's 4,000 subscribers in China. My general impression is that they tend to get their copies even when we put Xi Jinping on the cover or we put China buys the world. They do censor us on newsstand, and they rip. They rip pages out, but they don't. It's a hands-off relationship to the extent that we send it and then they do stuff to it. That's the easiest way to put it. But they're reasonably friendly to us.
Well. Thank you very much, John, for speaking. We do appreciate it. And while he didn't mention it, in fact, there are signs already of greater diversity and change at The Economist. Because I remember talking to people there about 20 years ago, and they said you pretty much have to go to Balliol College at Oxford in order to go anywhere. And every year they got somebody from Balliol. And John is part of the new diversity policy at The Economist because he read history at Magdalen College at Oxford. So change is in the air at The Economist. Thank you all for coming.
Thank you. I should add that my predecessor also read history at Magdalen.